So I'm Terry, and we are continuing today our series, kind of looking again with fresh eyes at some Old Testament stories that are sometimes troubling or hard to understand. And if you've been here previous weeks, you know that every other sermon we had a little kid's story with Matthew. Is Matthew here tonight? I haven't seen him. No. So the reason we didn't do that tonight is because, for the life of me, I couldn't think of a way to tell this story to kids without traumatizing the heck out of them. So even with Matthew's talent and his great big tree. So I'm going to be talking about Sodom and Gomorrah tonight. And if you've encountered that story before, you know why that would be troubling. Now, I'm just going to dive right into the story. It's a lot of text, but I want you as much as possible to stay engaged as I read this, because I'm going to ask you some questions about it afterwards. So it's in Genesis 19. The two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed low with his face to the ground. "My lords," he said, "please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet and spend the night and then go your way early in the morning." "No," they answered, "we'll spend the night in the square." But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him and entered his house. He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast, and they ate. Before they had gone to bed, all the old men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can know them." Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, "No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who've never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do with them what you like. But don't do anything to these men, for they have come under the protection of my roof." "Get out of our way," they replied. "This fellow came here as a foreigner, and now he wants to play the judge. We'll treat you worse than them." They kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. But the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness so that they could not find the door. The two men said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we're going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were pledged to marry his daughters. He said, "Hurry and get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city." But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. With the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished." When he hesitated, why the heck is he hesitating? Anyway, the men grasped his hands and the hands of his wife and of his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, "Flee for your lives. Don't look back and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away." Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, destroying all those living in the cities and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife looked back and she became a pillar of salt. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the land of the plain, and he saw dense smoke rising from the land like smoke from a furnace. So when God destroyed the cities of the plain, he remembered Abraham, and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived. I'm going to just pray before we move on. Lord, just help us to faithfully read and listen to this story in ways that you intend us to hear it. I pray that you would bless us as we open ourselves to the story you're telling to us today, and help us to leave with a commitment to follow you with all our hearts. Amen. So, next slide. I just want you to reflect before I go any further on what do you think this story means? Why do you think this story is in the Bible? What are your assumptions about it? And then also reflect just for a moment, are there parts of the story that are troubling to you or that you have questions about? Okay, I just want you to sort of have your starting point clear. So when I spoke about Abraham and sacrificing Isaac several weeks ago, I found these coloring pages for kids. And as I was preparing this sermon, I thought, I wonder if there's some of those for this story. People actually have their kids color these. So here's one. You can see Lot's wife in the background turning to salt. Here's another one, same kind of thing. The next one was horrifying to me. I have no idea what that means, but this is something people intend for their kids to color. Next page. This is a little activity. Help Lot and his family flee from the town of Sodom. And then this was horrifying to me, frankly. Connect the dots of terror, you know, basically. This is Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt. Up close and personal. So it's always fascinating to me that people that, I don't know. Anyway, I just thought instead of a kid's story, we could have some fun with that. But I will share now what makes me uncomfortable about this story. There's several things, but two major things have made this a story that I really have wrestled with. The first thing is that I think this story has been used in really terrible ways to sort of demonize a community and set ourselves against that community. So that's the first thing that's troubling to me and that has caused me to wrestle with this story. The second thing is that I think it contains a portrait of God that's troubling to me, of a pretty violent portrait of God incinerating a whole city of people. Now, I don't have all the time in the world, and neither do you, so I'm going to set aside that second concern, and I will deal with that next month when I get up to speak, not with this story, but with another story. So I want to focus on that first part of my concern. And so for the purposes of tonight, I want to grant to any of you who believe that God did incinerate this whole city that he actually did that, that that's something that God did personally with his own hand, incinerated the city. And I want to ask the question, why would he do that? What would cause God to do that? Now, to really appreciate what's going on in this story, as is often true in Scripture, by the way, if you're reading something that's troubling to you, read around it. So to understand this story, we're going to need to back up to the previous chapter and actually go back a lot further. But for now, I want to read the first part of chapter 18. So the Lord appeared to Abraham near the trees of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance to his tent in the heat of the day. Abraham looked up and saw three men standing nearby. When he saw them, he hurried from the entrance of his tent to meet them and bowed low to the ground. He said, "If I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, do not pass your servant by. Let a little water be brought, and then you may wash your feet and rest under this tree. Let me get you something to eat so that you can be refreshed and then go on your way. Now that you have come to your servant." "Very well," they answered, "do as you say." So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah. "Quick," he said, "get three seahs of finest flour and knead it and bake some bread." Then he ran to the herd and selected a choice, tender calf and gave it to a servant who hurried to prepare it. Then he brought some curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them. While they ate, he stood near them under a tree. So next slide. I can't really imagine more of a contrast to how these strangers were treated in this previous chapter, that juxtaposition of this story to what happens to those same people in the next story. That's pretty radical, and I think it's on purpose. I think there's a reason. If you if you think about it, Abraham took all this care, and the text goes to great lengths to talk about that. It goes into great detail. Like, this is pretty prime property, the Bible, you know, if you get words in there, if you get a story. It's pretty prime property. And so if they take the time to show that, that's intentional. And so I think we're supposed to notice the difference between what Abraham did and what happened when those same strangers went to Sodom. I'm going to talk. This is basically a description of ancient Near East hospitality, okay? Now, today, when we hear the word hospitality, this is kind of what comes to mind. Like, we have a professional hospitality industry, right? But if we go to the next slide, this is what hospitality actually means: the friendly and generous reception and entertainment of guests, visitors, or strangers. Now, prior to pretty recently, that's what happened with individuals and with communities. It wasn't the sort of the domain of a professional industry. And this is what the hospitality industry actually tries to do. They try to make guests feel comfortable and welcome and all of those things. But that's really a big part of our job. In the ancient Near East, if you were traveling, hospitality, like we think of that as a cute little word or, you know, an optional thing. But hospitality was the difference between life and death if you were traveling. Your life literally was in the hands. You depended on the kindness of strangers, okay? And the Bible is full of passages commanding Israel, and then also later Christians, commanding us to welcome foreigners, take care of strangers, take care of the poor and the needy. That was a big part of our vocation as people of God. Now, I think that's just as important today. Later on in chapter 18, so in the beginning, he receives these strangers. In between, you have that story where they announce that Sarah's going to have a baby, and Sarah laughs and all of that kind of stuff. But at the end of the chapter, right before the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham starts to he starts to bargain with God, because God lets him in that he's going to destroy the city because of its wickedness. And so Abraham gets into this sort of bargaining thing with him. And he basically says, "Will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there's 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do right?" So God basically says, okay, if there's 50 righteous people, I'll spare the city. And then he starts to bargain. Well, what about 40? What if there's 45? What if there's 40? What if there's 30? What if there's 20? What if there's 10? He goes all the way down to 10, which, by the way, I think those numbers are immaterial. But at the end of it, he says, fine, if there's 10 righteous people, I will spare this city. Now, what's interesting to me about that little exchange right before the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is that this actually represents a pretty new theological thought, okay? Prior to this point, it was generally accepted all over the ancient Near East that the innocent could get caught up in the punishment of the guilty. That was just the way it was. Everybody thought that way, okay? So whole communities would get punished for the wickedness of a portion of that community. That was how people thought. But this, the thought that perhaps the guilty could be spared because of the innocent, was a brand new theological thought. That was unheard of. Abraham was basically pushing God to be merciful based on God's character and for the sake of the innocent. And God agrees to this, okay? So now, you have this tale that's been told over the centuries, as a warning about the consequences of sin. But here, you have this glimpse of grace breaking through, beginning to break through. We find hints here of redemption and mercy and the power of goodness. And that's something to pay attention to. Now, I'm not minimizing the wickedness of Sodom. Nobody does that. Nobody should do that. This was some pretty awful stuff, right? But let's talk about that wickedness. Now, in order to get to that, I want to read you something that might seem really unrelated, but you're going to have to hang with me. In the 16th chapter of Ezekiel, the prophet is basically addressing Jerusalem at a time when they're about to be judged. And here's what he says about their origins. Now, you guys, pay attention to this. Pay attention to how God is talking to them and telling the story of how they came to be. The word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, confront Jerusalem with her detestable practices and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says to Jerusalem. Your ancestry and birth were in the land of the Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. He's using family terms to talk about the people that are their enemies. On the day you were born, your cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water to make you clean, nor were you rubbed with salt or wrapped in cloths. No one looked on you with pity or had compassion enough to do any of these things for you. Rather, you were thrown out into the open field, for on the day you were born, you were despised. Then I passed by, and I saw you kicking about in the blood. And as you lay there in your blood, I said to you, live. I made you grow like a plant of the field. You grew and developed and entered puberty. Your breasts had formed and your hair had grown, yet you were stark naked. Later I passed by, and when I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your naked body. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord, and you became mine. I bathed you with water and washed the blood from you and put ointments on you. I clothed you with an embroidered dress and put sandals of fine leather on you. I dressed you in fine linen and covered you with costly garments. I adorned you with jewelry. I put bracelets on your arms and a necklace around your neck. And I put a ring in your nose, earrings on your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head. So you were adorned with gold and silver. Your clothes were of fine linen and costly fabric, embroidered cloth. Your food was honey, olive oil, and the finest flour. You became very beautiful and rose to be a queen. And your fame spread among the nations on account of your beauty, because the splendor I had given you made your beauty perfect, declares the Lord. That's a pretty awesome origin story, right? He's reminding them that he came from these people who were their enemies, that those are their mother and father, and that they were hopeless until God came along and cared for them so beautifully. And he didn't do that because they were special. He did it because he wanted to use a particular people to bless the whole world. Now, notice again the hospitality and care that God showed and how beautiful and loving that language is. This is how God is, and he expected us to do the same thing to the people that surrounded them. Then, in that same chapter, Ezekiel goes on to recount the unfaithfulness and sin of Israel. And Sodom comes up here. This is why I'm telling you this story. And it comes up in a kind of surprising way. Ezekiel refers to Sodom as Jerusalem's sister. So he's using these family terms. But the comparison takes a pretty surprising turn. He says, now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable things before me. Therefore, I did away with them as you have seen. Samaria did not commit half the sins you did. You have done more detestable things than they, and have made your sisters seem righteous by all these things you have done. And then later he says, you would not even mention your sister Sodom in the day of your pride before your wickedness was uncovered. Now, this sort of unfavorable comparison would have been really shocking to the people who were hearing it, okay? This is why the prophets weren't exactly popular people. They said things that made people really angry, and this was very insulting to them. But basically, God is saying through this prophet, not only did you sin in the same ways that Sodom did, but your pride makes it even worse. I took you out of these hopeless circumstances, and I took care of you, and I expected you to do the same, but you forgot where you came from. You forgot what your vocation was. You forgot that you were slaves and foreigners before I came to your rescue. And now look at you. Look at what you've done. You've managed to make Sodom look good. You've managed to make your sister look good. They had drifted so far from goodness that not only did they fail to welcome strangers and foreigners, they raped and killed them. And you're worse than them. I mean, this is pretty graphic stuff. Now, notice what God describes as a sin, or what Ezekiel, God through Ezekiel, describes as a sin of your sister Sodom. Arrogant, overfed, unconcerned, failing to help the poor and needy, haughty, and doing detestable things. Okay? I used to hear this story a lot preached, and I never heard about that. and I think there's a pretty good reason for that. Those are things, I don't know about you, but those are things that I have to look at. Like, I gotta think about that. That hits me as an American Christian, right? So that's interesting to me. And as I mentioned before, this hospitality, this word that we take as pretty lightly, was a matter of life and death for people who were traveling in need, foreigners, strangers. And I started to wonder how connected is the things he's talking about here. The arrogance, being overfed, unconcerned, failing to help the poor, these kinds of things. How connected are those things to what ended up happening in that town, to how they treated strangers? Because in order to sort of justify treating people that way, right, and sort of what Ezekiel's describing there is sort of this self-centered, me first, you know, kind of thing, which is real familiar. I wonder how connected that is to what happened in Sodom, because I think in order to justify those things, you have to dehumanize people, right? You can't be talking about specific people, you know, who are a lot like you, right? You got to make them different. You got to make them wrong. You got to make them evil. And then you can justify whatever the heck you want to do. You got to make them those people. And now this isn't the only place in the Bible where Sodom's sin is brought up with no mention of what is normally associated with this story. It happens a lot. And even Jesus, when he's sending out his disciples, he sends them out and says, I want you to go out vulnerable, okay? Don't be prepared. Don't go out prepared. I want you to be vulnerable when you go out so that you're relying on the hospitality of people you don't know. And then he says this, if anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, leave that home or town and shake the dust off your feet. Truly, I tell you, it would be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. So he's talking again about hospitality and the consequences of treating people in a way that demeans who God has created them to be. In fact, most of the places where the Bible talks about Sodom and Gomorrah, it's not doing it to highlight their sin. Their sin was bad, okay? But most of the places, I didn't do a comprehensive study, so I can't say all, but most of the places where it does this, it's It's a device to highlight the pride and the sin of Israel in comparison. It's like God is saying over and over again, you think you're so above your sister Sodom? You do not want to go there. And that's a warning to us. Because this is precisely what the American church does with this story. They use it as a sort of a cautionary tale. It's supposed to be a cautionary tale of what, how serious it is to not care for people and to treat people with such disrespect and so violently. This is a cautionary tale, but we've used it as a way to demonize and hate a particular person, a particular kind of person. And it's become a way for us to sort of feel superior and not have to look at our own stuff. Now, when I was talking to Dave about this story, he reminded me of that parable in Matthew 18 of this, the ungrateful servant, you know. He owes this unbelievable, unpayable debt to this rich guy. The rich man forgives him. And then he turns around, finds somebody who owes him a pittance, and throws him into debtor's prison. And when the rich man finds out about it, he's pretty angry, and the story doesn't end well for that first guy, right? And that's a warning for us too. You guys, what God is saying over and over again is don't use this story that way. Because what it's going to do is end up highlighting your own failures. The story of Sodom and Gomorrah is really not the story that you've come to believe. It's part of a bigger, more beautiful, sweeping story that God is telling, and he's still telling it. It's the story of the long journey towards mercy, towards a return to the urgency of hospitality and gratitude and forgiveness and mercy. In a world that really practically dares you to look out for yourself, right? That's the trajectory. And it's at the expense of those who really need love and care. So I want to read you a poem, because that's what I do. And this is a poem to help you remember times when you were the stranger and how beautiful it was to receive a welcome. It's called Welcoming Blessing. When you are lost in your own life, when the landscape you have known falls away, when your familiar path becomes foreign and you find yourself a stranger in the story you had held most dear, then let yourself be lost. Let yourself leave for a place whose contours you do not already know, whose cadences you have not learned by heart. Let yourself land on a threshold that mirrors the mystery of your own bewildered soul. It will come as a surprise what arrives to welcome you through the door, making a place for you at the table and calling you by your name. Let what comes come. Let the glass be filled. Let the light be tended. Let the hands lay before you what will meet you in your hunger. Let the laughter, let the sweetness that enters the sorrow, let the solace that comes as sustenance and sudden unbidden grace. For what comes, offer gladness. For what greets you with kindly welcome, offer thanks. Offer blessing for those who gathered you in and will not be forgotten. Those who, when you were a stranger, made a place for you at the table and called you by your name.